Deiver Mahasa, August Faucha, Godi, Vela Litrieta, on Dangan. August Gurev Mahagiv, Asavehlin, Igor, Nahokoida, Specialta Shaw. And I'd like to welcome you all to the Dingle Literary Festival and thank you for joining us. And I'd also like to thank our hosts here at the Dingle Bookshop on Green Street. We are delighted to be able to welcome Paul Muldoon to the festival. Paul, I thought we'd start where we are, i.e. in West Kerry, and perhaps work from there. Maybe up towards the border and across into County Armagh, and further afield, and then out to perhaps New Jersey and the Delaware.
Sounds like a great plan. I have to say that I would quite happily begin over there and work my way back here. I mean, this is a place to which I feel particularly attached. And I've felt attached to it really from the first time I came to Dingle, which was in the wake, like so many, in the wake of Ryan's Daughter. And that was in the very early 70s. And I came back and forth over the years. And then in 1986, I actually lived in Dingle for most of that year. And, I feel very attached to this place. It's as if everything is here, you know, whether one's interested in history, in geology, in language, it's all here. And it's an extraordinary place. And I can imagine, indeed, coming back here, I'm not quite sure if I'll ever manage it, but I certainly can easily imagine living in Dingle, or out west, as we say. What I thought I'd do, just to honour that, if I may, is the pack shot, is to read a poem or two from this collection, which is called Kerry Slides. Kerry Slides, of course, are it's a kind of music, a form of Irish music, the Kerry Slide. But in this case, it was presented as a series of photographs, slides, in that sense. And there were photographs by Bill Doyle, a great photographer who since moved on, but I did a lot of work for the Irish Times. So these are little imagistic poems. I thought of this one as I was driving in yesterday by Anna Scall. I was always kind of amused by the idea of a wall around a graveyard. So this is a little poem about that. Twilight, the graveyard at Anna Scall. Its 6 foot high wall is hardly about to keep anyone in and no one out. Which I'm sure you realize is pretty deep stuff. But in any case, I'm just amused by the height of that wall. In any case, let me see. Here's another little imagistic poem which refers to, well, actually, this one refers to a cocktail that was served in one of the local bars during the 1980s. There was a famous shipwreck out there, the Ranga, which was washed ashore out back near Cuminol, I believe it was, and lay there for quite a few years on the rocks. I was amused just by the pun in the name of this alcoholic beverage, this cocktail. So, a fisherman nurses his Ranga on the rocks, the rusty cocktail named after a shipwreck, then knocks it back, the actual. So again, short little imagistic poems. I've always been fascinated by the Japanese tradition and indeed the extent to which, as Kuno Mayer once pointed out, the extent to which the early Irish poems, so many of them, the nature poems, are of a piece with that imagistic tradition. So this is 6 sods of turf fell out of Peg's basket. She bent to gather them up, the blaskets. And that's Peg Sayers, of course. And Peg's old woman's reflections, or however it's translated. You know, just one of the remarkable series of books that came from, I don't even know if I mentioned literature earlier on. I mean, the literature from this part of the world, from the early 20th century, and then right through the 20th century, has been quite remarkable. So, I'm blaring on about Dingle. I'm a Dingle fan.
No, and you've been here on a few occasions, actually.
I come into Dingle often. Yeah, I come in as often as I can.
You sometimes come in under the radar. I remember meeting you outside a certain establishment on Strand Street that sells ice cream.
That's right. Well, I don't want my ice cream habit to be as widely broadcast as it might. I'll tell you. I mean, I could have mentioned ice cream earlier on. As being a feature of the Dingle landscape, but anyway, so much.
I was wondering whether you might read something from Moy Sand and Gravel, which is behind us here. There's a couple of poems there. Mm-hmm. Would you?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Well, I have a selection from it. Moy Sand and Gravel is a book that came out in 2002, I think it was. So this is one from it. It's a poem that's set in the house that I lived in for quite a while in New Jersey. I've taught at Princeton for many years, actually for almost 35 years. And I've lived in a number of houses there. And in this particular one on the banks of the Delaware and Raritan Canal, a canal built by, I think, substantially by Irish men, Irish navvies, navigational workers. And indeed, when I lived there in this house, which had been built, the canal was built in the 1830s, I'm pretty sure, and about a decade that coincided with a huge cholera pandemic, by the way. And many of these Irish workers died from cholera. Many of them died, I think, just from the severity of their labor. But I often, at some level, their spirits or their ghosts were still lurking about the place. I mean, I'm not sure if I believe in that. But I'm not sure if I don't believe in it. I'm one of these people who, even though I sort of belong to the modern world in some sense, I would be very reluctant to cut down a fairy thorn, for example, if I had one.
The shkak gal.
Indeed. I mean, I just wouldn't go there. But in any case, what else should I be mentioning? Oh, there's an instance here, an allusion to an instance of contemporary famine in Africa. And I heard this detail of people washing out horse manure to retrieve the whole grains. And it's a shocking image. And there are a number of shocking images in this poem. And in fact, at some level, I think I'm interested in poems that are shocking in some sense, not necessarily, that they can't be broadcast before 9 o'clock or 11:30 at night. Just that at some level, they should change how you think about things. Anyway, I give you a jolt. So, I think I've said everything I might about this. The loaf. When I put my finger to the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster, stiffened with horsehair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the gain all the way from Raritan to the Delaware with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain of the canal after a hurricane and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain with a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain, with a wink and a wink and a winky wink. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed with a link and a link and a linky lick.
Something extraordinary about that poem, isn't it? How you found that image.
Well, you know, yes, what I'd say about that actually is that I don't myself find them. I believe totally, utterly in if one's open to the possibility, you know, and basically just, you know, alert. I'd say almost supine. If you walk out into a field, there's a strong chance you'll be hit by something, lightning possibly. And, you know, in that sense, I think the image found me and the poem found me. I mean, for example, that refrain that it has, which is a kind of nonsensical refrain with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick or whatever it is, and then obviously when I started the poem, I had no idea that it would allow me to continue in that vein. And the fact that it did, I put down totally to it, you know, to it knowing what it was doing. Mm-hmm. Certainly not to me knowing knowing what I was doing. I mean, I've said this many times, I'll say it again. People think I'm slightly crazy, but who cares? I mean, I actually don't really think of myself as writing these poems. I think this is true of many writers and indeed musicians and I think visual artists. They feel visited by something if they're super lucky. So anyway, that's... Mm-hmm. I put it down to trying to be at the service of some force, you know?
And, of course, waiting for these things to happen, by and large, you have to be at your writing desk.
Well, that's,
or do you?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, I do occasionally get a little, what used to be called a little, a little piece of... What's the term they use? Inspiration, you know, a breathing upon from beyond. It's again a force from beyond. Maybe just a phrase or an image that might prove to be fruitful. But I think in general you're right. I mean. I think I generally sit down every day, not necessarily to write a poem, not at all to write a poem, but usually writing something. And, you know, it's maybe only for an hour, maybe half an hour, maybe a couple of hours. But I think I can only figure out what it is that the poem is about through the process of allowing it to get written. So in that sense, you have to be present. I have to be present anyway. I'm sure other people do this in different ways, but I myself have to be there and have to try to be alert is the word I used earlier on, I think, and I'd use it again, open to what it wants to do, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I sometimes go to the Tyrone Guthrie Centre in Animacarrick, which I'm sure you know.
Yeah, I do. It's a fabulous place.
It's a fabulous place, you know, in that sort of border region of County Monaghan. And it feels that things do kind of happen there, you know, not always as in terms of work and so on. But one of the things I always think when I'm there, I always think about some of those poems that you wrote about various other artists and so on, you know, which you've done a bit of.
First of all, the Animacarrick Tyrone Guthrie Centre, as I say, is a fabulous place. And when I lived in Belfast, which I did, you know, I was there from 69 to 86. But certainly after Animacarrick opened, I was very lucky to be able to avail of it. And to, you know, because I was working full time, and it's very nice to be able to take a week or 2 weeks and just you know, have nothing else to do but to stand out in that field and wait for something to happen. And the sense that you've gone there, of course, and that actually, I mean, there is a little sense that one had better come back with something. Otherwise, you sort of feel you're wasting somebody's time. And, well, wasting your own time, it doesn't really matter, but there's plenty of that. But so anyway, I've met a lot of very interesting artists there, including artists from, you know, so many different realms. I've always been very interested in the visual arts. And in fact, I think in many ways, poetry writing, I was talking earlier on about these little imagistic poems, some of the earliest poems from the Irish tradition. And of course, imagism as a movement in the early part of the 20th century, or imagism, the pun on Emmy Lowell. But that, I think of poetry writing as actually often being a very visual activity. You know, you're looking at this, then you stop looking at that, and then you're looking at something else, and there's a reason why one's doing it. It's the same as making films. You know, there's a reason why the shot changes, or at least there should be, and the motivation for the shot, as they used to call it. So, I mean, among the people I met there was a great painter going strong, Dermot Seymour, a Belfast painter, and I must say I'm a big fan of his work, and have, you know, had the privilege of using some of his paintings as covers.
That's right,
on
this very book.
There's a book,
The Annals of Chile.
The Annals of Chile, which has a painting by Dermot on the. Let me see what's in here. On the cover. And in fact, that would make sense because, for example, here there is a poem which is set in the vicinity of Animacarrick. Just comes to hand there. Do you notice that? And which is dedicated to Dermot Seymour. And it's a poem, it's a kind of musing upon cattle. I mean, at the present time, I think there's a feeling that the cow, which has been such a feature of Ireland, Irish landscape, Irish literature, needless to say, you know, may soon be a thing of the past. I think the cow presents a bit of a threat play a very particular role in global warming and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, this was a little musing, let's call it that, upon the cow. And it was written, when would this have been written? Sometime in the
90s.
Was it? Yeah, I suppose so. We came out in 1994. It's a little bit of amusing on some of the, you know, some of the what would one say, the border activities over the years. Cows. Even as we speak, there's a smoker's cough from behind the Whitethorn hedge. We stop dead in our tracks. A distant tingle of water into a trough. In the past half hour, since a cattle truck all but sent us shuffling off this mortal coil, we've consoled ourselves with the dregs of a bottle of Redbreast. Had Hawthorne been a gale, I insist, the scarlet A on Hester Prynne would have stood for alcohol. This must be the same truck whose tail lights burn so dimly, as if caked with dirt, 300 or 400 yards along the Boreen, a diminutive form of the Gaelic, Bohar, a road, from Bo, a cow, and Har, meaning in this case something like a thwart. Boreen has entered English through the air, despite the protestations of the OED. Why, though, should one tail light flash and flare, then flicker fade to an after image of tourmaline set in a dark part jet, part jasper or jade? That smoker's cough again. It triggers off from drumlin to drumlin an emphysematophon of cows. They hoist themselves onto their trampoline, steady themselves, and straightaway divine water in some far-flung spot to which they then gravely incline. This is no Devon cow coterie, by the way, whey-faced, with spode hooves and horns, nor are they the metaphysic cattle of Japan that have merely to anticipate scoring a bull's eye, and lo, it happens. These are earth flesh, earth blood, salt of the earth, whose talismans are their own jawbones, buried under threshold and hearth. For though they trace themselves to the kith and kine that presided over the birth of Christ, so carry their calves a full 9 months and boast licorice cashews on their tongues, they belong more to the line that's tramped these coombs and corries since Cuchulainn tramped Aoife. Again the flash, again the fade. However I might allegorize some Oscar-a-Buscar, a binary bevy of cattle, there's no getting round this cattle truck. One light on the blink, laden with what? Microwaves? Hi-fis? Oscar-a-Buscar, a binary, a twin entwined, a tree, a Touareg, a double dung beetle, a plain and simple high-firing party, and off the back of a lorry, drogue. Enough of Colette and Celine, Celine and Paul Celan, enough of whether Nabokov taught at Wellesley or Wesleyan. Now let us talk of slaughter and the slain. The helicopter gunship, the mighty Kalashnikov. Let's rest for a while in a place where a car has lain.
Thank you, that's lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah. Shall we move up across the border and maybe to your kind of home place, you know? County Armagh, and some of the poems that have arisen out of that, out of your younger life, perhaps.
We could do that. No, along the way, might just actually read a poem that represents a drive right the way up through Ireland, as it happens from Dingle, to Belfast, where I lived for a long time. But it might get us kind of in a sideways fashion to Armagh. The poem's called Christos. Christo, of course, the great artist. Long after I wrote this poem, which I wrote in Dingle, by the way, I must have. I actually met Christo and Jean-Claude, his partner, and he, of course, was the with the great artist who delighted in wrapping, covering in fabrics of various kinds, islands in Florida, I think it was, and a bridge in Paris or Rome or wherever it was, a building in Germany. He was a wrapper. And in the WRAP sense. But anyway, so I kind of have a bit of fun with this. And we'll see what happens. Christos. Two workmen were carrying a sheet of asbestos down the main street of Dingle. It must have been nailed at a slight angle to the same sized gap between Brandon and whichever's the next mountain. 9 o'clock. We watched the village dogs take turns to spritz the hotel's refuse sacks. I remembered Tralee's unbiodegradable flags from the time of the hunger strikes. We drove all day, past mounds of sugar beet, haystacks, silage pits, building sites, a thatched cottage even, all of them draped in black polythene and weighted against the northeast wind by concrete blocks, old tires, bags of sand at a makeshift army post across the border. By the time we got to Belfast, the whole of Ireland would be under wraps, like, as I said, one of your man's landscapes. Your man's? You don't mean Christo's. So there are two speakers there, the main speaker of the poem and then this other character. I've always been interested in the dramatis personae, as it were, of the poem, the characters of a poem. I mean, including the speaker of the poem, who is not necessarily, though sometimes not a million miles removed from the historical character who wrote the poem or had the poem written through them, as in that case. But, it's all fiction, too, you know, fiction that's kind of moving back and forth into reality and maybe, I suppose at some level, the idea is that maybe helps us to understand reality, or there are those, of course, who would go so far as to say maybe even bear reality, you know, face reality.
You have talked about, you know, the persona in your writing before, haven't you? You know, that notion that we adopt, you know, a persona. Do you do that in your writing?
Well, you know what I'd say to that, honestly, just as you say it, it occurs to me, I'm not quite certain who I am at this moment, you know? I mean, I'm someone who's talking and I'm connected in some way to Paul Muldoon, but I mean, I don't go around, you know, talking like this. You know, this is a very particular set, a very particular situation, a very particular contract where I have to talk in a certain way and try to, you know.
That's right. It was, wasn't it Philip Larkin who said he hated going around the country pretending to be himself?
That's right. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, you don't do that. You're doing other things. You're just pottering about. So, you know, there is a, yeah, so the character in the poem is connected to oneself often, but
maybe voice is a better way of,
you know,
getting at that.
Certainly, that's a concept. I mean, a voice is a fascinating concept. I mean, and we talk about, say, the poet who has found their voice, her voice, his voice, their voice, and we know what we mean by that. But I always think of that as a retrospective thing rather than a prospective thing. And what I mean by that is this. You know, when you read Philip Larkin, whom you just mentioned, you read a poem and you think, Philip Larkin wrote that poem. You know, only Philip Larkin could have written that poem.
That's right.
And so that's the retrospective. When Philip Larkin was sitting down, I'm pretty sure, to write his poem, or when Yeats was writing down, or John Donne, or Marion Moore, or whoever it was, Nolan O'Connell, whoever it might be, to write their poem, they're not thinking, hey, here I am writing in the voice of Yeats or Nolan O'Connell. In fact, that's the last thing they're thinking. Mm-hmm. In fact, what they're thinking is, I don't want to sound like Nolan O'Connell mm-hmm. or W.B. Yeats. So, I mean, we understand. I do understand by what is, I think, by what's meant by that idea of the poet finding their voice. Okay, that they come to a point where there is something, if they're very lucky, where there is something recognizable about them, you know? But it's not in the sense, I think we tend to think of it, you know, one day I'll find my voice and after that, it will be plain sailing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just turn on the voice and there it'll be.
It'll come.
It'll come. No. So in that regard, see, in that regard, I believe, there's nothing, I don't think I'd be alone in this if one thinks about it. Each poem finds its own voice. That's the key, I'd say. That's the trick, is to find the voice for that poem. And now, again, retrospectively, someone will look at the poem. Someone may look at it. It's quite conceivable. No one will ever look at it, more likely. But if someone might look and say, yes, I know who wrote that, but that's not for the poet to think about, I believe.
Yeah, that idea that the poem will succeed or it will come to nothing, you know. So the poem has control over that in a sense.
Well, yes, it needs to find out how it has to be, mm-hmm. you know. It has to find out what its vocabulary is, what its tone is, which is a complex business. You know, it includes vocabulary, point of view, whether or not it's ironized, just what its terms are, what its... I mean, in a strange way, when I said term, I mean almost that in the sense of termin, you know, of a boundary. Mm-hmm. Terminus or termin in Irish. What its defining characteristics are. And those are not really evident, if even then, until the poem is finished, right? So that of course is the great adventure. That's why we do it.
Yeah, I'm thinking of your poem. We talked earlier on about your poems like Unsure and Roundabout. You know, mm-hmm. which seem to come. Well, they begin with that word, don't they? With that sort of, well, certainly Unsure. You know, that sort of you begin with a word and the thing develops from there. Would you like to read that poem?
Sure. I mean, funnily enough, I was up a few months ago, and I go back quite often to the place where this poem is set, College Land, in County Armagh. Let me just get it here. Unsure You know, in the north, of course, Irish wasn't on the curriculum in the primary school, but we did use a few words. We were encouraged to use a few words of the old Irish, and you know we would, like, for example, in Will Cadogam Gullamach, do I have permission to go outside to go to the toilet, for example. And the roll was conducted with the answer to whether or not one was present in Irish, Anshaw, which of course is which is pronounced in a slightly different way in Dingle, I believe, but I'm going to pronounce it in the Donegal fashion because I'm from up that neck of the woods. what do we see? I don't think there's much I have to say about this, really. Anshaw. When the master was calling the roll at the primary school in College Lands, you were meant to call back Anshaw and raise your hand as your name occurred. Anshaw meaning here and now, all present and correct, was the first word of Irish I spoke. The last name on the ledger belonged to Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward and was followed, as often as not, by silence, knowing looks, a nod and a wink, the master's droll. But where's our little ward of court? I remember the first time he came back. The master had sent him out along the hedges to weigh up for himself and cut a stick with which he would be beaten. After a while, nothing was spoken. He would arrive, as a matter of course, with an ash plant, a sally rod, or finally, the hazel wand he had whittled down to a whip lash. Its twist of red and yellow lacquers, sanded and polished, and altogether so delicately wrought that he had engraved his initials on it. I last met Joseph Mary Plunkett Ward in a pub just over the Irish border. He was living in the open, in a secret camp on the other side of the mountain. He was fighting for Ireland, making things happen. And he told me, Joe Ward, of how he had risen through the ranks to quartermaster, commandant. How every morning at parade, his volunteers would call back Anshaw and raise their hands as their names occurred.
Thank you, Paul. We've just time, I think, now for perhaps maybe one or two more poems just to finish up. I can throw it open to you, if you like.
Maybe...
Read one of your choosing.
Well, let me see. Maybe I'll read a more recent poem, and this is a poem from the book that came out just the other day. The book is called Howdy Skelp. Howdy Skelp. And let me see something that might represent that. You know what? I'll read a little short poem. It's the first poem in the book. It's called Wagtail. And, you know, one of the things I miss about not living in Ireland is the wagtail and a few other birds. Little trotty wagtail as it's known, as it's referred to by John Clare, little trotty wagtail. And I've just, you know, funny enough, I saw one the other day. You know, the way they come over a ridge and then they go down and then they come up again. And there's something about that movement that I just find very moving in some way, you know, and I connected in the poem with the image of a little boat going over a piece of rough water. I mean, it's not it's not, not you know, it's not an earth-shattering image, but it's just, I don't know, there's something very poignant to me about, you know, having sight of a thing and then losing sight of it, and, you know? Anyway, Wagtail, what did we say? Sometimes, as I turn a corner in County Tyrone, a roof of PVC or corrugated iron will scintillate no less persuasively than an unperturbed stretch of Lower Lough Erne, abutting the lost kingdom from which my family hails. Primarily a thatcher, my grandfather knew mange was a complaint to which his Clydesdales were all too prone, yet may not have recognised dementia as a trait of the Muldoons. Sometimes a phrase such as "Hugh had begun to dote" will weigh as a Clydesdale's withers would weigh with withies, while the pied wagtail crossing freshly turned furrows is a tiny rowboat, glimpsed now and again in the trough between storm waves. I mean, and the sort of coming and going there, and that little tongue-twisty line, will weigh as a Clydesdale's withers would weigh with withies, which are the kind of Sally rods or whatever. I mean, it's as if one's not quite sure which of those words to settle on. And it's I mean, I think at some level it's a kind of enactment of maybe, you know, a little bit of losing the mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, dementia, of course, was not a term that was used when I was a kid, but there were other ways of describing the phenomenon, you know. Yeah, that's just a little poem.
Perhaps one more?
One more. Thank you very much. I'd be glad to do one.
It's been a real pleasure, Paul, to
have
you here.
Thank you very much indeed. You know what? I'll read a little bit. What do we see? Hold on. Something short would be good. Something short's always good. here's one. It's called The Sheet. And it's just a little snapshot of something happening in a square, a village square, somewhere in Italy, I think. Not sure. Somewhere on the continent, as they say, or used to say. Anyway, and it's just a little image, and I'll end with this. I want to say just, you know, what a pleasure it is to be here, and thank you so much for allowing me to be part of your festival, albeit, what word do we use? Virtually. Virtually. Anyway, it's great. Always great to be in Dingle, virtually or otherwise. So, The Sheet. We were sitting in a village square, not so very much broader than the bridal suite that overlooked it. The suite where we'd spent at least part of that afternoon extending our modest repertoire of love forays and love feats. Now we made do with playing footsie at a cafe table while pondering fettuccine with sage. Plein air or en plein air? You checked your iPhone. A culinary herb, native to southern Europe and the Mediterranean, once thought to grow best in households where the wife is dominant. Even though the supporting evidence was far from scant. This was a theory I must put to rest, given the frantic smoothing out of air by the man and two young boys hoisting a sheet through what was irreparably twilight. A grandfather and, you surmised, his two grandsons were about to run a test on the projector that had only recently become a prominent feature of our lives. It looked very much as if the eggplant was introduced to the West by Alexander the Great. As to whether normal wear and tear could have accounted for the rip in your Himalayan wrap, itself a shade of aubergine in a blend of wool and moire, the jury was still out. Acquainted though we'd been with the fact cellulose nitrate is notoriously unstable, we were nonetheless taken unawares when the reel of film began to disintegrate, even as images of what looked like some of our earlier exploits were thrown up on the screen.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to have you here at the Dingle Literary Festival.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for being here.